I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate. And some scientists think that one way to fight global warming could be to dump large amounts of iron into our oceans. Even though experiments seem to support that idea, no one knows for sure if it would work or not. And critics say that large-scale environmental tampering might be too risky. With me now to tell us more about ocean iron fertilization and whether it's worth considering is Dr. Scott Doney, a senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Welcome.
Hi, Julie.
First, could you explain how putting iron in the ocean could help combat climate change?
Well, what we're trying to do, or what the theory is that in the ocean you have microscopic plants that we call phytoplankton.
Mm-hmm.
And just like the plants that grow in your garden or the plants that grow in an agricultural field, they need light and they need nutrients. And in some parts of the ocean that are far away from the continents, that one of the key limiting nutrients is the trace element iron.
Which would have floated into the sea on runoff and things like that from the iron in soil?
Actually, not so much out of rivers, because the iron that comes down out of rivers, a lot of it gets deposited right near the coast.
Is that why the silt in rivers is so rich and dark and looks like iron?
Well, that's one reason. Actually, when you mix fresh water and salt water, when you mix river water and salt water, you have a lot of organic matter.
Mm-hmm.
And when you change the salinity, it actually tends to flocculate. It forms this white particulate organic matter, and that strips out a lot of the iron.
Ah, okay.
For the open ocean, the regions that have been discussed, some of the iron comes from the sediments off the continents, and some of it actually comes from atmospheric dust. So, for example, from the Sahara and the Sahel, or from the Gobi Desert, you get these dust storms that transport dust thousands of miles out into the open ocean.
And then does the dust just settle on the ocean, or does it need to rain down? How does that work?
Some of it comes out with rainfall, and then some of it just, we call it dry deposition, which just means, you know, the air currents waft down and some of the air hits the surface of the water and the little bits of particulate dust get stuck on the water surface, and then they start to sink into the ocean.
So the amount of iron, I would guess, is one of those nutrients that the phytoplankton need.
Yes.
And does the amount of iron then determine how many phytoplankton how much can grow?
Yeah, one of the things that was was an enigma for many years was if you went, for example, to the Southern Ocean off of Antarctica, there was plenty of light during much of the year, and there were plenty of the other limiting nutrients, things like nitrogen and phosphorus. But the phytoplankton weren't growing as fast as we would expect, and there just weren't as many of them. And there was a fellow named John Martin, who was based out in California, who came up with the idea that perhaps it was iron. And he did a series of experiments, first in the laboratory and then out on ships, and then finally on the large scale by dumping iron into the ocean, showing that if you add iron to those particular ecosystems, the phytoplankton just take off. You can have a tenfold increase in the amount of phytoplankton over a few weeks.
Wow.
Because they're basically sitting there, they're starving for iron. That's the thing that will jumpstart their growth.
So it sounds like if we added iron, the phytoplankton would proliferate. What would happen next?
Well, that's one of the questions that many scientists have been trying to answer. There have been now about a dozen of these open ocean, we call them iron fertilization experiments. You drive out in a ship and people actually spread a solution that has iron in it into the surface ocean, and then they monitor what happens. You know, what happens to the phytoplankton, what happens to other parts of the ecosystem. What we do know is when the phytoplankton grow, they use up some of the other nutrients. They draw carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and
just
they
like
fix
plants
that.
Do.
Just like plants do on land, just like a tree would do. And they fix that CO2 into organic matter, into their tissues. What's less well known is what happens to those tissues. If somebody comes along and eats the phytoplankton, or if they die and bacteria decompose them, then that carbon dioxide that's been drawn out of the atmosphere really doesn't go anywhere. It sits in the surface ocean and then exchanges back with the atmosphere. In a few of the experiments, people have seen some of that organic matter sink into the deep ocean. And we know that's a natural process, that's how the food web in the deep ocean survives, is by small amounts of organic matter sinking down from the surface ocean. But the question is, how much of the, you know, if you were to think about it in an engineering sense, you know, you add one aliquot of iron and you get so many aliquots of carbon.
What's an aliquot? I'm sorry to stop you, but it's okay.
Yeah, a ton of iron.
A ton.
And you get so many tons of carbon formed into organic matter.
And is an aliquot a ton, or was that just another form of measurement?
Oh, that's just it's a jargony chemistry term. Sorry.
Oh, okay. That's okay.
And then you want to know how much of that carbon sinks into the deep ocean, because it's only the carbon that makes it into the deep sea that really would act to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere for a long period of time.
And I think I'd read at some point that people were thinking about taking CO2 and putting it at the bottom of the ocean in some way. Is that this method, or are there other methods too?
Yeah, there are other methods. This, you know, one way is you might want to think about the iron fertilization of the phytoplankton is just like trying to grow tree farms on land. You're trying to use enhanced natural biological processes that remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Another way would be more of a engineering or technological solution, which would be to, if you had a power plant, instead of venting the combustion products, venting the smoke and the carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, you would strip out the carbon dioxide and you would put it someplace.
Mm-hmm.
You could put it down into an old oil well, for example, or you could inject it into the deep ocean directly, you know, put a pipe into the deep ocean.
Now, with the iron fertilization and the plankton, have people done models of thinking, all right, if we did this many tons or aliquots, this is
Sorry,
how
don't,
much...
Don't use aliquots. That was just a bad...
I like the sound of it, but...
Yeah.
we would be able to remove this much CO2 from the atmosphere? Have there been projections about what might happen?
Well, what is tempting about the phytoplankton, and this is why it's gotten the research community interested, but also a number of commercial companies, is that in the end, we need to, if we're going to manage atmospheric carbon dioxide, we have to do it on a very large scale. We currently emit about 8 billion tons of carbon each year to
Wow.
the atmosphere. And so anything we were to do to slow that down, we have to do on a very large scale. One of the tantalizing things about iron fertilization is that the phytoplankton need only a very small amount of carbon, or excuse me, very small amount of iron to fix a lot of carbon. So the laboratory experiments suggest that the ratio is something like 30,000 to 1. So for
Wow.
every one molecule of iron, you're getting 30,000 molecules of carbon. And that's what's gotten people's attention. Then the question is, well, do we want to do this? What are the other environmental consequences? What are the legal consequences of pursuing this?
Well, that was going to be my next question is, okay, this sounds really interesting, but it may not be the same thing, but I remember hearing about algae blooms that were really destructive to the rest of the ecosystem of a particular part of the ocean.
Right.
Is that true with phytoplankton as well?
Well, there are several different consequences. First off, any time we're going to tamper with the environment, we're going to change the ecosystem. When we add iron, we don't just increase the number of phytoplankton, we change the composition. So it's, you could think of it as, you know, you had grass in your yard and you added fertilizer and suddenly the trees started growing faster and your lawn turned into a forest.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're going to be doing. We know that there are particularly rare phytoplankton in the regions that are iron limited, and those are the ones that actually bloom when you add iron.
Mm-hmm.
So any of the other animals in the plankton, as well as fish and other species up the food chain, they're going to see a different food source.
So that it could be like, what is that weed? Is it kudzu that was introduced to this country and took over because it was able to crowd out the native species?
Right. Now, in theory, as soon as you stopped fertilizing with iron, unlike some of these invasive species like kudzu or zebra mussels, the weed species that would grow up in a fertilization event really do need iron, and if you were to stop fertilizing with iron,
they wouldn't be able to grow.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
There have been some suggestions of there's some suggestions that by shifting the composition of the plankton, you might have environmental consequences, and we're not exactly sure what those are.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that's under study. Some of the other concerns are when that organic matter, you know, the goal of this is to form organic matter and put it into the deep ocean. When that organic matter gets down to the deep ocean, it's eventually going to get decomposed back into carbon dioxide. But when you have that decomposition by bacteria, you need oxygen, and so you actually use up oxygen in the deep ocean. And so one of the concerns is if you were to scale iron fertilization to a large enough scale, you'd actually change the oxygen distribution in the ocean. And we're not actually sure what that would do to fisheries and to other parts of the marine ecosystem.
Because fish depend on oxygen in the ocean.
Fish depend on oxygen, though interestingly, some of the most productive fisheries are right over the top of oxygen minimum zones because they're coupled. The oxygen minimums occur because you have a lot of biological productivity in the surface waters above.
And this kind of decomposition is going on, and so the oxygen is less.
Right. The last complication is when you tinker with the ecosystem, we're not just changing the production or release of carbon dioxide, we're going to affect other chemical species as well. And there are actually some chemicals, particularly methane and a compound called nitrous oxide, that are formed when organic matter decays. And those two gases are also very potent greenhouse gases.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is some observational evidence suggesting that you might be able to draw down carbon dioxide, but you might produce these other greenhouse gases, and the net effect on climate might be much smaller than you originally thought.
That you might be trading one difficulty for another.
Right.
How do scientists wrestle with this as they evaluate, is this a good idea or a bad idea?
Well, up until now, most of the experiments have been done for, I would call it, people interested in ocean ecology. We knew there were these large regions in the ocean where phytoplankton growth was limited by iron, and people wanted to see if we add iron, what would be the biological changes.
So you were doing it to try to figure something out, not
right.
to affect a change, but to say what would happen if we did this.
But, and also not to study the impacts of iron fertilization as a deliberate, you know, engineering of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that myself and a number of colleagues have been trying to do is figure out, well, you know, whether I think it's a good idea or not to do, there are companies that are trying to pursue this. we don't want it to occur in a scientific vacuum. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't want the companies alone to be the ones who declare victory and say, yes, this is a very useful technology. So we've been trying to come up with, you know, what would be the research that would need to be done to make sure that the environmental impacts were well known, and assess whether those impacts are livable. And in the end, that's not really a scientific decision. You know, we provide the information to society. Society has to decide, you know, what are the trade-offs of, you know, of drawing down CO2 worth the destruction of this amount of marine habitat or the change of this amount of marine habitat.
It's interesting that you say companies are interested in this, and that surprised me. But then I thought, well, I don't know who regulates the deep ocean or the ocean that's very far from any continent. Is that something that governments control, or is this kind of a Wild West where a company could say, you know what, I'm going to go over here and dump a lot of iron and see what happens?
Well, let me just back up and tell you a little perhaps why companies are interested. And I think some of them are actually interested because they see climate change as a very serious problem, and they're looking for solutions.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a very large market right now, not so much in the United States, but in Europe, in what are called carbon emission credits.
Right.
Basically, you're paying, you need a permit to emit carbon dioxide, and if you don't have enough of those permits, you have to buy some from somebody. Right now, you can't use ocean fertilization to generate one of these credits, but the credits are selling for, you know, something like $30 a ton of carbon dioxide. And when you start to look at the potential for ocean fertilization, you start to see numbers that are in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, that's when you said, what was it, 800 billion?
Yeah, the total emissions from power plants and cars and home heating is right now is about 8 billion tons of carbon.
8 billion tons. So yeah. Multiply that by 30, and that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. When it comes to the regulation, within the what's called the exclusive economic zone, that's 200 miles out from shore, that's controlled by individual countries. So you couldn't go off the coast of New Jersey and dump iron into the water. First off, it wouldn't work because it's not an iron-limited area. But second, you'd be in violation of United States law. So within the jurisdiction of individual countries, the countries get to make up their own rules. Out in the beyond the jurisdiction, out in the open ocean, there are some international treaties. There is something called the London Convention or the London Protocol, which says that you shouldn't dump things that are bad for the environment into the open ocean. And if ocean fertilization were to go forward, you would have to modify that international treaty in order to make it legal for iron fertilization to be done. The problem is who enforces international law.
Right, who's out there patrolling 200 miles offshore?
No one is patrolling. And it's really up to the individual nations to enforce on, for example, if you're a U.S. flag ship, you have to follow U.S. law.
We only have about 30 seconds left. I know you have on your website at Woods Hole a 6-part series of articles on ocean iron fertilization. And is there any place else that you'd suggest people who are interested go look for more information about this?
Well, that would be a good start. And we actually have other references up there. And basically at this point, a lot of it is coming out in the newspaper. It's moving so fast that we try to maintain our website to keep up on the local news, but that would be my suggestion.
Well, Dr. Doney, thank you so much for talking with us today on The Leonard Lopate Show.
Very nice to talk to you.
On tomorrow's show, what went wrong in the Israeli-Palestinian relations between 2001 and 2006, from the collapse of the Camp David negotiations to the Israel-Lebanon conflict. Also, the world premiere of Seven, a play about extraordinary women around the world who work for change. The latest in our States of the Union election series looks at the upcoming Nevada caucus, and Please Explain is all about delegates. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Rory Bernstein and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Julie Burstein, in today for Leonard Lopate. Thanks so much for listening.